Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota nor a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. This is the word of the Lord.
Praise be to God. You may be seated. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you again. My name is Koen Prins, a pastor here at the church, and we are going to continue our sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount, a whole sermon series of 10 Sundays on just one sermon from Jesus. But his words are so rich that it really takes some time getting through. And actually, today's passage, this is just the intro of a longer passage that we're going to study today. We're going to rush through. There's so much in there, but we're going to have to rush through this, not being able to spend all the time in the world on it. So if you allow me, I'll just dive right in today. In this couple of verses that we just read, something significant happens in Scripture. There's a turning point. And in this passage, in these words of Jesus, the whole focus of Scripture on what it means to serve God and what it means to live your life to the glory of God, the whole focus of Scripture here turns from the law of Torah to Jesus. The whole focus of Scripture shifts from the law to the grace of Jesus and the way of Jesus. At the same time, Jesus gives the strongest possible confirmation of the law of Torah. Not a dot, not an iota will pass away from this. If you relax it, you'll be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But if you teach it and if you live it, you'll be called the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. At the same time, he gives the strongest possible confirmation of the law, but also shows it is not able to accomplish what it should accomplish. It's not able to get us completely there. Have you ever driven around in your car and you heard a noise somewhere and you were like, I hope this will go away by itself? Yeah? It's me. Long time ago, old car, and you're just driving around, you hear it's like tick 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 tick. You're like, please make this go away just by itself. I don't have any money right now. I don't want to go to the mechanic. It never works like that, does it? It always gets worse and worse, and you're like, all right. So what Jesus does here is he's like the car mechanic that is opening the hood to show, hey, there's a problem here. What the law was doing was, Paul calls it in Galatians 3, a babysitter. It's helping, it's symptom management. It's like these things come to the surface and we need to manage them. We need to kind of legislate them. We need to kind of keep them. We need to give something external to make sure that people will kind of abide by what it means to live the good life, what it means to live life in the way of God. But the law was not able to really deal with the root issue. And in Jesus, in the passage that we're going to talk through, he's like, he opens the hood and shows, hey, there's actually a real big problem with the engine. And you can do all kinds of symptom management and stuff like that and kind of regulate and legislate, but there's a problem with the engine that we need to get through. And that's the very real problem of human sin. And that's a problem that happens in the heart. After this passage, Jesus will go into some very hot topics in the law. Real stuff, real life stuff, anger, lust, divorce, speaking truth, relating to people that are against you. And in that, every time he hits the deeper layers of the heart where the real battle is going on and where the real battle would be won. He shows us that The real battle is not in our outward behavior, where stuff comes to the surface, but it's the state of our heart and our inward attitude to the outside world where it happens, where the mistake is, where things are going wrong. It's our hearts that Jesus came to fight for, that he came to redeem, that he came to reorient. And so from a healthy heart, we could begin to live life God's way. And so in a way, Jesus is showing us here where the real problem is. And I'll say a little bit more later about what he did to to really redeem that, to release our hearts, to give us a new heart. I'll say something about it a little bit later. But here he shows, like, if you can get your heart set on God, if you can seek his kingdom first, if you are willing to deal with the root issue beneath the sin that comes to the surface, that's what needs to happen. So he's also showing us the way to live life his way. And we cannot do that all by ourselves. Something more significant needs to happen. But he's at the same time showing us the problem, but also showing us the way out. And that's how we're going to approach this. I want to say a few things before we dive into all these passages that will come after what we just read. Because we first need to think a little bit about our disordered desires. Jesus, every time he talks about one of these topics, he'll say something like, "You've heard that it was said, but I say unto you." So you've heard this law, this thing that dealt with whatever is coming to the surface, but I say unto you, I'm going to hit the deeper layer beneath this sin of the real problem, the sin problem that every human being is dealing with. And he's revealing that the problem is not in behavior only, but there's a problem of the heart. Sin has corrupted and blurred the very desires of our heart. The thing is, human beings are lovers. We are desire creatures. God has created us for love, by love, to love, in love. We are lovers. We are desire creatures. We desire things. Many people say we live from desire, certainly not always from rational decisions. We live from desire. Yet that love, that the desire in us, it has become corrupted. What we want is not always what is good, beneficial, and right. And the problem is not that we don't desire. We certainly desire. The problem is that we desire the wrong things, or that our desires are disordered. We can understand them as higher desires and lower desires. Lower desires being instant, short-term, right here and right now. And they are usually desires of the body. Higher desires are more long-term. They are about who am I becoming and what do I leave behind. And usually they have to do more with the spirit instead of the body and with the soul instead of the self. The problem is our strongest desires are not always our deepest desires. Our strongest desires are not always our deepest desires, because our desires are disordered and have been corrupted by sin. Now, dealing with our disordered desires has always been difficult. It's always been difficult to say no to something that you feel an urge for, a desire for. But in recent times, it's not only the stuff that's going on in the inside, you know, the sin problem that we're dealing with in our hearts. It's really also the culture around us. Christian philosophers are usually pointing back to the early 20th century psychologist Sigmund Freud as a turning point in our recent culture as it began to focus more on the lower desires than on the higher desires. Freud said something like this: repression of desire is the basis of all neurosis. Anyone studying psychology that can confirm this? Yep, so on one hand. Repressing of desire is the basis of all neurosis. Or in other words, as our friend John Mark Comer kind of explains how Freud thinks, the reason that you're unhappy is because you are letting other people tell you what you can and cannot do. Sounds familiar? This is kind of the thinking of our postmodern world. It started with Freud, but it's been picked up. And even though he's been refuted by psychologists today on almost every point that he made, it still made its way into our general sense of thinking about how to live life. Currently, the ultimate sin to commit is not following your heart, not being true to yourself. The self exists to be explored and indulged and expressed, certainly not disciplined or restrained. And so as we discuss the topics that we are about to discuss, we need to understand that what Jesus is doing in these passages, speaking to our disordered desires, is possibly more on point today than it ever was. Where Freud said that we are imprisoned and enslaved by rules and regulations, and true freedom is saying yes to our desires, Jesus reveals here that actually it's our disordered desires that are imprisoning us and enslaving us. Quite the opposite. Jesus points to a deeper and a higher desire, that to be holy. This is the narrow path that we're talking about. And when we undergo a change of heart through the grace of God and let Jesus reorder our desires to point us to a way where we can flourish and live deep and meaningful lives, that's where we begin to live his way. We're going to jump in to the different topics that Jesus discussed. Jesus was talking about them. I'm going to discuss them. I'm going to say a few things about them. I'm not going to be able to hit every nuance of every passage. Every passage would certainly deserve a full sermon or a whole book. But we don't have time for that today. We're going through the Sermon on the Mount in only 10 Sundays, and this is a long passage. It might also become a little bit of a long sermon, sorry, but I know that you can take it. But also, I must warn you before we dive in, this is not for the faint of heart. So I hope you're not faint of heart, because Jesus is saying some very radical stuff. Like, we'll dive right in. Like, he'll say some very radical stuff. He invites us to make some very radical decisions from a radically changed heart to live radically different lives. Okay, we're starting with the topic of anger. Jesus says, "You heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say unto you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." Okay, that's quite radical, Jesus. "So if you are offering your gift at the altar and you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put into prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." Right. The problem of anger and connected to murder. Every law, I think of every culture, has prohibited murder. This is common sense. You cannot take someone else's life just like that. Now, there's different standards and different sort of circumstances that those laws will be around, but it's a common understanding that you cannot just take someone else's life. Jesus, in this very short statement, immediately drills down to the layer beneath murder, which is the issue of contempt. Murder is a symptom that may come to the surface, and restricting that by law is very good. But the real problem is happening in the heart. The problem is the contempt that we may hold towards others. When we hold others in contempt, we dehumanize them in our hearts and effectively wish them dead. Restricting the action does not solve the real problem, because the real problem is happening in the heart. And there's a call to action on how to then live radically different, how to immediately deal with the issue of contempt that is happening in our heart. Jesus gives a very practical example of reconciliation. And funny enough, he's not saying, if you're there at the altar and you remember that you have something against someone else, no, he's saying, if you remember that someone else has something against you, it may not even be your fault. He says, go, leave your gift there and be reconciled. See, Jesus wants us to live radically reconciled lives so that there's no space for contempt in our hearts because it's poison. Why is reconciliation so important to him that even like we can't just like hold a little bit of a grudge against someone? I mean, some people just really deserve that bit of a grudge, don't they? Why not? Why is this such a big issue for Jesus? Well, perhaps because reconciliation is at the very core of the gospel. Jesus says it's better to take the high road and humbly do everything in your power to seek reconciliation than to give any space for contempt in your heart. The words you speak in contempt don't only dehumanize the other, they dehumanize you to the level even of a murderer. Moving on, I said we don't have too much time for all these things, but I'm just going to try to let Jesus' words kind of speak for themselves. Next issue is the one of lust. Okay, we're going to spend a little bit more time on that one. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away, for it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Now, these are probably the most radical and explicit words on living a holy life of Jesus in the Bible. And just a quick, like, raise your hand if you've actually put this into practice. Oh, wait, you wouldn't be able to. You wouldn't be able to do that. I'm sorry, but you got that right away. See, what Jesus is getting at is, everyone knows is true. Christian and non-Christian, we all know it's true. Question is, if you'll be as concerned about it as Jesus is. Fantasizing about having sex with someone that is not your spouse is adultery of the heart. And it will set you on track to actually commit adultery and destroy every life connected by this breaking of covenant. You have to be careful, though. Jesus is not against sex or sexual desire, even. I mean, these are God-given things, and they are good. It's just that these desires so often get disordered and corrupted. And life in the modern world has not really made it easier for men and women to move away from fantasizing and entertaining lustful thoughts. Sex is commercialized and commodified to the point it's almost impossible not to be confronted with images that stain your soul. And then there's also pornography, which is so easily available and has become such a serious and ongoing battle for nearly every man on the planet and increasingly more women. Here's a quote I found in the book Live No Lives, again by a friend, John Mark Comer, who you've gotten to know through the Practicing the Way course now. And I think it will be helpful as a cultural commentary on life today. He says this, "It's not bad to love sex. God himself created us as sexual beings and commanded us to increase in number. But when sex becomes a pseudo-god that we look to for identity and for belonging in a community or for life satisfaction, when it becomes soteriology, a doctrine of salvation, And it is, as it is for so many in the West, that's a disordered love. And it's not just that it's wrong in the moral sense, it's that it can't possibly satisfy the deeper ache of the soul for love, intimacy, acceptance, and generativity. After all, the body just wants an orgasm, but the soul wants more, communion and contribution. Jesus' radical view on holy living calls to radical action. He says, chop off that hand, gouge out that eye. I mean, what are we to do with that? What is he saying? I think it's too easy to dismiss it as hyperbole. I don't think he's asking us literally to do that. But I think it's too easy to dismiss it as hyperbole. I mean, honestly, I would rather go through life half blind and mutilated than letting my instant short-term urges and desires drag me down to actually F up my marriage by committing adultery. Honestly, I'd rather be half blind and mutilated. So this, how hyperbole is this actually? I think he's calling for the most radical measures that you can take to make sure that you don't go down this path. So what does the right hand and the right eye then stand for? I think it could translate into two things. I think one obvious connection to mother time is the connection to viewing pornography and masturbation, the eye and the hand. And we are to take Jesus' warning very seriously here. These are things that will bring us to a very dark place. It will stain the soul. It will drag us down to actually do damage. So if you need to remove every screen from your life for a couple of months, then make a plan and do so. If that's what it takes to break from porn and masturbation, then go for it. Take it seriously how strong the warning of Jesus is in this case, because he's calling you to a holy life. Secondly, I think Jesus even speaks to a deeper level here. The right hand that he refers to in his time was also the hand of power. And I think we can take his instruction here to say something that if your position of power would lead you to committing adultery, then be so brave to lay that position down, to step away from that position so you're not tempted into something like adultery. I mean, how many people in positions of power, Christian and non-Christian, does it take for us to recognize that a position of power makes you vulnerable to these type of things? I think Jesus is effectively saying that there is no job, no position, no ministry, no role worth holding on to if it's going to cost you your faithfulness to your spouse. Moving on to the issue of divorce. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. All right. This certainly deserves a whole book or a set of books. And I'm just going to say a few things, and I'm definitely not going to hit any of the new ones that's connected to this. What I will say is that I think the issue Jesus is trying to get at here is not that people don't divorce well or not for the right reasons. And it's not a debate over the reasons. I think the issue it is getting at is that people do not have a high enough view of marriage. And I think this is still the biggest topic around this today. The story of the Bible begins with the marriage of Adam and Eve, and it ends with the marriage of heaven and earth, of Jesus and his bride. The union of husband and wife in marriage points us all to the union of Jesus and his bride, of God's faithfulness to his creation. So it's the very core of the whole gospel that we live for and that we share. That is what makes marriage such a sacred and beautiful thing. and also such a vulnerable thing, and why the opponent, why the Satan loves attacking Christians on this. Again, not being able to address every nuance that's connected to this sensitive and personal topic. These are also pastoral matters where every case requires wisdom. But let me stick to the major point. I think we need to approach marital issues even with a much higher view of marriage, acknowledging that it is sacred and that divorce would be only the last resort, indeed, if there is no other way out. Moving on to our words and honesty. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say unto you, do not make an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than that comes from the evil one. I was once in Central Asia, and me with a whole group of people, and we were at a certain restaurant, and I wanted another drink, so I was asking one of the waitresses, hey, I'd like a Coke, please, because that's what you do when you're in a foreign country, you just drink a lot of Coke, so your tummy doesn't get too upset, so I'd like another Coke, please. And the girl said, yes, and then went away and never came back. And I'm like, okay, that's odd. It's some for asking another waiter, can you bring away Coke? She says, yes, and she brought it. And the others, some of them from that country, explained to me, yeah, you asked the wrong waitress. She was not allowed to serve our table. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. But why did she say yes and not know you should ask that one? Because I would have gotten that with hand. why did she then say yeah? Yeah, if she would have said no, that would be impolite. That's so ineffective. But sure, I don't get different cultures. See, when Jesus checks under the hood of our speech and how we make our promises, he quickly arrives at the core, just saying that let your yes simply be yes and let your no simply be no. It's funny how children actually instinctively take what you say as a sure promise. If I say, no, you can't have ice cream now, but perhaps later, in my daughter's head, that means there's a sure promise for dessert tonight. We will have ice cream. That's daddy promised. And I'm like, no, I didn't promise. I just said that we might. But that's a sure promise. Difficult as this may be for parents, and also crafty little manipulators as children can be, they do have the right expectation when it comes to our words. They are in their full right to expect that what we say is as sure as a promise. It's instinctively they know, this is a promise because daddy said it would be so. It is going to be so. That is a promise. I found this quote from a theologian called Hauerwas that I really like, that I think is going to be helpful for us. I think we lie often, not because we are liars, but because we are moderately good people who don't want to hurt anyone. And therefore, we often restrain ourselves from saying what needs to be said because we don't want to live with the results. This is not an excuse for Dutch people to be what we call direct. If you've been in this country for a little while, you've probably heard some Dutchie say that, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be blunt, I don't mean to be offensive, but I'm just direct. That's a sad excuse for actually just being, Dutch. 15 years in international community has really helped me to become a little less Dutch in this, but still, I can be Dutch. But I think it is a call to honesty and to saying what needs to be said. I mean, it's like somewhere between passive aggressiveness and being direct and rude is the kingdom, right? I think Jesus is calling us to be honest. And I've heard it said, like, it's honesty brings unity. And I think that's actually true. There are certain things that we avoid to say that actually would need to be said, it would be good to say, but you just don't want to deal with any friction. It's a difficult road to travel, but Jesus is calling us onto the road of full honesty and integrity. Moving on, retaliation. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. And give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. I've actually once put the turn the other cheek thing into practice. I was 17 years old. I think three or two weeks later, I was going to be baptized. I was in my radical phase in youth. And I somehow got into a fight that I should have never gotten into with this other guy, like an argument. And our classmates kind of set us up to fight. And I was like, no, I don't want to fight. I'm not going to fight. Like, I was wearing the What Would Jesus Do bracelet. And I was like, what would Jesus do? Like, Jesus would turn the other... There's another bracelet that says, like, Jesus wouldn't get into the situation in the first place. But that was too late. So I was looking at my What Would Jesus Do bracelet and thinking, I am not going to fight this guy. I am going to turn the other cheek. And thus is what happened. He punched me full on the one cheek. And I turned the other cheek, where he punched me as well. And then someone broke off the fight because he's like, oh, Kuni's not going to fight. This is boring. So that saved me. What this was, though, for me in that time was a sure breakthrough moment to break through the aggression that I had for many, many years. I wore the mark on my jaw like a badge of honor because I was like, something has really shifted inside of me where in primary school times, I would jump at a fight. I was aggressive. I felt insecure. Like I wanted to kind of prove myself and then jump in a fight. But here I was like, no, like I don't even need to do it. I don't want to do it. I'd rather be punched again than jump at this. And I think this is the main thing that Jesus is after here, is to give us a path of radical nonviolence that breaks our desire for retaliation, for pride, for self-reliance, but instead fully love and serve even our opposers in the way of Jesus. And that leads us to the next one. I think this connects so well to the prayers we've just prayed for the persecuted church. Jesus goes on, like closing off this part. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That sounds very normal and very logical. Love your neighbor, be nice to the people around you, but hate your enemy. But Jesus says to us, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. I'm just realizing we prayed for the persecuted church. We did not pray for the persecutors. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brother, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. The way of our salvation was paved with the radical self-sacrificial enemy love of Jesus. He taught it and he modeled it and he multiplied this in his followers. This verse, Matthew 5:44, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. People say it was the John 3:16 of the early church. For them, this counterintuitive instruction actually became second nature. they understood the call to enemy love as an intrinsic part of what it meant to belong, to be citizens of heaven, to belong to the kingdom of heaven. The manner in which Jesus brought about salvation also become the manner in which his message of salvation spread throughout the world. And we are called to follow in his footsteps, follow in the footsteps of Jesus and the earliest followers of Jesus, and practice radical enemy love. All right, I want to move on, close off with two simple takeaways. And I say simple because they're simple points from the passage, but are not simple to put in practice. The first one is this: you need a changed heart. Every issue that Jesus addresses in this part of the message, he is revealing that the problem is actually in our hearts. The problem is in our deeper desires. The problem is what's going on beneath the surface and not what's coming up to the surface. He's revealing the heart behind the laws that were given to Moses in the desert. And Jesus shows that these laws were there to restrict bad behavior, but the real issue is in the heart. Something that no regulation, no education, or modification would ever be able to fix. Through Jesus, death and resurrection, we not only receive forgiveness and restoration from everything that sin has destroyed, whether it be sin done by us, to us, or perhaps around us, he also gives us a new heart. He gives us a new way forward so that we are able to begin living what he's teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. Ezekiel said many centuries before Jesus, "I will give you a new heart and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules." The words of Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount will only begin to make sense, only begin to be remotely attainable after we have been reborn of the Spirit with a new heart. It's only from the changed heart that we can begin to live in the way of the Sermon on the Mount. And so, perhaps this is just a simple invitation to you. Receive a new heart today. Give your life to Jesus. Surrender it to him and to his lordship. And say, "Lord, give me a new heart, because from this heart I am not able to live in your way, even though I really want to. I get stuck with my instant desires, with my urges, with whether that be urges to immorality or to hate or to retaliation or all of these things. I'm getting stuck in that." My message to you is, don't try to do better, but ask for a new heart, because he has a new heart for you today. And the second point is one of holiness. Be perfect as your Father is perfect. And our first reaction is like, "Yes, but that's impossible. And that's the whole point. And that's why you have grace." And that is 100% true. But Jesus' call still stands. Holiness is a worthwhile cause to make some radical decisions for. Holiness is a worthwhile cause. It's got nothing to do with getting qualified for God's love or something like that. It's responding to everything that we have received from him. And it's being set into freedom. Holy people are happy people. Holy people are free people. It's worth making some radical decisions for. Jesus calls us to radical reconciliation, radical purity, radical commitments, radical love, radical speech. The path is narrow and it will not be easy. But the holy and pure life that flows from those radical steps is absolutely worth it. In fact, it is the deepest desire of that changed heart to live holy.